So John summoned two of his disciples
and sent them to the Lord
to ask, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" When the men had come to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask,
'Are you the one who is to come,
or are we to wait for another?'" Jesus had just then cured many people of diseases, plagues, and evil spirits, and many who were blind. And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." When John's messengers had gone, Jesus began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who put on fine clothing and live in luxury are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'See, I am sending my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' I tell you, among those born of women, no one is greater than John, yet the least in the kingdom of God is greater than he." And all the people who heard this, including the tax collectors, acknowledged the justice of God, because they had been baptized with John's baptism. But by refusing to be baptized by him, the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves. Hear what God is saying to the people. Well, to those of you who are students, congratulations, you've made it this far.
I realize there's probably still
a few more assignments to eke out, a little more bloodletting to happen, but by and large, it's done, and congratulations on a successful semester and on for the good work that you have done. I trust that it's been a formative experience, not just for the immediate present, but also for your future work, wherever that takes you. I want to take a moment to make a couple of acknowledgments before I share my message. The first one is to thank our worship planning team, not only for the worship service today and for all of their good work, but also for their consistent work throughout the semester and the work that they do even next school into the next semester. So thank you. We all have participated in worship planning at some point in our lives, and we realize there are a lot of details that go into worship planning, a lot of thoughtfulness, a lot of attentiveness, and so we appreciate your work. Thank you very much. I'd also like to acknowledge, again, the ministerial guides who are present with us, and I'm going to ask them to stand because we had them stand and we blessed them, but we didn't get a chance to name them. So would you mind rising where you are? So I'll start over here. So Emily Schwenker continues to serve as a ministerial guide right now and has been with us a while. Randy Riggs, who's been a ministerial guide in the past. Chad Martin, who is serving as a guide right now. Harry Royer, who has served many, many years as a ministerial guide. And David Bell, who served as a ministerial guide in years past and is now retired onto better things, important things. Did I get everybody? Thank you. There were a number of other ministerial guides who were planning to attend. Some of them had personal issues, emergencies that prevented them from coming. But it was actually kind of beautiful to look at the last 10 years and to see the number of pastoral leaders that have worked with us in the past 10 years and to think about the great work that they've done. And I'll say a bit about that in the message. But I just want to say on behalf of all of us how much we appreciate your work, how we appreciate your ministry in the world, but also your ministry among us. It's made a difference in the life of our community, and it's made a difference in our ministry, both the students and the faculty and staff. So thank you. Please join me in prayer. Gracious God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts and the desires of all our hearts be acceptable unto you. For you are our rock, our redeemer, our life. Amen. My first text message from my niece in Wichita, Kansas, and she is a new mother. About her daughter was born about 6 months ago. Landry is her name. And you can imagine what I got in this text picture, or the picture with a text in it, or picture in a text. And it was Landry's first sitting on Santa's lap, right? And she looked adorable. She looked obedient. She wasn't crying or screaming. She's probably too young yet for that moment in the cycle of things. And as I looked at that picture, I not only smiled, but I could easily imagine, as well as you could, what the interchange was like between Santa and Landry, right? It's a pretty common exchange. Santa Claus would say to Landry, "What's on your Christmas list this year, Landry?" Right? Even though Landry can't speak and she's only 6 months old, still the question has to be asked. And probably, more than likely, my niece would have chirped in right away and supplied all of the things that Landry would like if she could speak. And it wasn't really much longer when I got another text, this time from my sister, with another picture, also this now about my niece. So my other one's my grandniece, now it's my niece. This niece is 5 years old. Her name is Madison. And of course, Madison is sitting on Santa Claus's lap, right? And of course, we have these pictures now from the last 5 years plastered on our refrigerator, sometimes screaming, sometimes, you know, squirreling, trying to get out of Santa's lap. But again, once again, I imagine now the exchange that happens. And Madison hated sitting on Santa's lap early on and was afraid of Santa. And of course, now the exchange is very different, right? So when Santa says, "Madison, what would you like for Christmas this year?" Madison is ready with her list, right? She can't write yet, but she knows how to make a list, right? And so my sister is dutifully taking note, listening to every word that Madison is uttering to Santa. It's always amazing to me that these exchanges, not only how they happen, but they're just so public, right? I mean, Madison, at this age now, anybody could ask her, a stranger could ask her on the street, "What would you like for Christmas?" And she would share it, right? When guests come to the house, that's what children do, right? They don't even have to be asked, but sometimes adults will ask, but regardless, many children will just go right up and say, "I've asked Santa Claus for a new train or a new toy," or whatever it is, right? They're free about it's just once they get the hang of it, they're very willing to share what their desires are. It's also the case, we well know, that not everybody have this practice of creating a Christmas list. Not every family can afford gifts at Christmas time. Sometimes a parent is in jail and isn't able to provide Christmas gifts for their children. In another case, a parent may be deceased and not be able to offer Christmas presents to a child. In other cases, a parent or both parents may be out of work, and so Christmas presents may be really out of the question, or medical bills are too high for people to be able to consider buying presents, let alone making lists. And it's certainly the case that during the Depression, there was no such thing as Christmas list making. I was with a group of senior citizens on Monday night in Columbia, and when I talked about Christmas lists, many of them said, "We never wrote them as children because we grew up in the Depression." Right? There was no such thing as Christmas lists. Nobody asked us what we wanted for Christmas. The truth is that many children go through their entire childhood never being asked what they want for Christmas, or what they want, period. It's also the case for parents during this time of year that most parents are probably wrestling with this very same dilemma, right? Do we ask our children what they want for Christmas? Do we ask them what they want for Christmas, even though we know we might not be able to accommodate their requests? And even if a family can afford to buy gifts, there is likely to be a lot of discernment, if not hand-wringing, over whether to buy what's on the child's list, right? We know the dilemma. If you ignore the list altogether, then you're seen as a mean parent, and you risk the chances of dispiriting the child. So somehow there has to be some acknowledgement of what their desire is. And on the other hand, there is the danger of buying everything that's on the child's list for fear that, and fearing that we might communicate to that child that they will always get everything that they want. I remember as a child making out a Christmas list. I have lots of stories, and I'll spare you all of those. But one of the things I also remember is being so excited about it and turning the question on adults, asking my parents and my grandparents, "So, Grandma, what's on your Christmas list this year?" And I distinctly remember on a regular basis a kind of discomfort entering into the room at that moment, trying to deflect the question, basically saying, "I'm too old for that. Christmas lists are for children." It seems obvious to me, and maybe to you, that we have a very complicated, if not uncertain and conflicted, relationship with our desires. With naming our desires, with sharing our desires, with exploring what would satisfy those desires. In the seasons of Advent and Christmas, we are being taught and are teaching about desire. In some ways, the Advent and Christmas season is an entire school session on desire. We're being schooled and we're schooled. What do you desire? What should you desire? Where should you share your desire? Who gets to have desires? What do you do when your desires aren't met? This is really one of the few times in our common life, not just in churches, but in our common life, where we actually have an opportunity and are encouraged to talk about, we say what we want, but I want to dig a little deeper, and I'm going to say it's really about what we desire. And even though there's so much attention paid to it, you can't walk into the mall or into any place, open up a magazine or watch the TV or listen to the radio without some discussion about what we should want and how our desires might be satisfied. And nonetheless, despite all of the attention, we're still as conflicted as ever. And I'm wondering that maybe it's because most of the time that real significant conversation about desire is frowned upon. It's much easier to talk about simple things, simplistic desires, rather than significant ones. And so as a consequence, desires of more substantial types are left to backroom conversations and confessionals and magazines and online hookup sites. I think one of the challenges is it's not easy to talk about the deeper levels of our desire. The truth of the matter is, it's really much easier to talk about wanting a new sweater or a pair of shoes or perhaps a toy, both an adult toy or a child's toy, than it is to talk about what we think might liberate us from our lives. To talk about desire on that deeper level requires a kind of vulnerability that is really quite difficult to manage. Now, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't go out and buy gifts for people. So this is not that kind of sermon. I'm not suggesting that. I'm fine if you want to go out and buy gifts. I don't have any objection to that. I don't think it's actually an either-or question. I really think about the fact is that desire is about, and the exploration of it is about the multi-layers of it. There are multiple layers of our desires and our needs. I think the other challenge is that I think if we think that if we talk about desire, then it's just going to make matters worse. Or that desire to talk about it will simply just increase our desires and expectations, which we know or expect will often go unmet, or even worse, be ignored. I had a situation like that. That was the way in which, when I was studying in Catholic seminaries, you never were allowed to talk about sex. Of course, because everybody was expected to be celibate. But the belief was is that if you talked about sex, then you would want it. As if somehow, if you didn't talk about it, you wouldn't want it. I don't think that works. I'm a living testimony, so, you know. Again, we'll talk about that later, so. The truth is that naming our deepest desires reveals our vulnerabilities. It reveals our places of need, our deep yearning, sometimes even our sense of loss and incompleteness. To name our desires means that we leave ourselves vulnerable to being hurt or disappointed. And yet, that's exactly what the Advent season is about. As a matter of fact, I would propose that the Advent season is about inflaming our desires. It's about stoking the flames of our desires. It's about naming our desires, even offering them up, knowing that the desire itself, even as we articulate it, may need to be adjusted, may need to even be purified and deepened. But wherever we start, whatever desire we name is a starting place, is an acceptable starting place to going to something deeper. We may not even have the right language. Sometimes it's a dull ache in our heart or in our stomach, a restless leg, or the inability to sit still. What I want to point out here is that the wider culture and the church at this moment in some ways are a little bit in sync when it comes to naming our desires as a central theme of the season. But we part company drastically on one point, at least. And that is that our wider culture would like to propose that there are ways in which we might satisfy those desires. And that whoever it is that's selling whatever that is that they're selling will actually do that, will bring you satisfaction. And the church actually doesn't intend to satisfy our desires. Instead, the church, the gospel, I think, wants to intensify. The challenge is to allow our desires to be so intense that they move us to greater life, that they move us to allow changes to happen in our life. Yes, you heard me correctly. The church invites us to think about our deepest desires and needs during this season and to allow those needs and desires to intensify, even if we don't know what will happen in the end, even if we don't know whether they'll get met or not, even knowing that the expression, the naming of those desires leads to a vulnerability on our part. In the gospel reading today that we heard from the gospel according to Luke, John the Baptist sends his people out to ask Jesus whether he was the one who is to come, excuse me, or should they wait for another? And Jesus' explanation here, response here, always fascinates me. This passage always fascinates me. Because Jesus, of course, doesn't really answer the question. He just says, tell them what you see. People are being healed. People are being liberated. People are being set free. People are hearing the good news. And Jesus doesn't ask this question, but I could imagine the back of his mind implicit in this is that what you were expecting to see? If John is asking the question, he's obviously trying to figure out, literally, it's not a fake question, but John is trying to figure out, are you really the one who is to come or not? Now, I know that this exchange between John the Baptist and Jesus, as well as the other people who are in the room, as part of a very long conversation in ancient Israel and within the Judaism of Jesus' time about the one who is to come and what kind of person that will be. And I think it's a very worthy conversation. It's a long-standing debate that we still have.
It's a debate about
what attributes the one who is to come, what the Messiah will have. Is the one who is to come the Messiah or not? Who is who in this kind of arrangement? But I want to focus my reflection in a slightly different way. Because I think besides entering into that conversation, that debate, Jesus also is trying to teach the community something about the human heart and our deepest desire. In other words, it's not just about a debate about what the text, ancient texts say about who it is to come and what the attributes of that person will be. There's that conversation, but there's also this other conversation when he turns to the crowd after John's messengers go away. And he asks them, what did you go out to see? That is to say, what were you hoping for? What were you longing for? What were you expecting? Were you expecting to find someone exalted? Were you expecting a celebrity? Flash? In many ways, I hear Jesus asking, what is it that you are really yearning for? Asking both the people of his time and I think asking us, what do you really yearn for? What is it that you think will give you life? That will liberate you? If you can get to those kind of questions, then everything kind of changes. I think then we get somewhere in the conversation around desire. And this is where I think our ministerial guides come in as such an important part of our community. Because if we want to get to that level of desire, we're going to need some help. We're going to need somebody to ask questions gently but consistently about what we really are seeking. There is work that we need to do on our own, but we need others. We need community. We need spiritual guides. And that's why I know many of you are so grateful to those who have served and who continue to serve as ministerial guides in our program. Because their key charge, I mean, amongst all of the things that they do, their key charge is spiritual discernment, which simply means, in my mind, to listen carefully to the heart of each student, to help each student name his or her desires, the desires of their heart, no matter how buried they are, no matter how outlandish they may seem, no matter how dismissed they may have been in the past. The ministerial guide is there to listen and to draw those out so that God can do something with the naming of those desires. I mean, we may not get what we desire, at least what we articulate, and we're not going to make that promise. I'm not that kind of creature. But I do believe one thing that will happen in the naming of our desires. I believe that God will hear us when we do, no matter how imperfect, whatever language we're missing, no matter what, and that God will be able to work with that articulation and to deepen it. That God can work with whatever kind of articulation and make and do something with it. Over longer, I believe God can help us name our desires more accurately. The Advent and Christmas season will bring many invitations to us to name what we want, to make Christmas lists, to name the deepest desires of our hearts, to stoke the fires of our desires and our dreams, not only for fine food and drinks and nice gifts, but also a desire for meaning and purpose, for liberation, relationship, desires for wholeness and courage, compassion and love. And I pray that maybe in the midst of all of it, we'll discover another desire. A desire to become more like the God that we worship. The God who desired to become human. May it be so among us.